Yeah, our next presenter is Bill Hurd. He got introduced in session three. I'm going to introduce him again. Bill Hurd has worked on Chinook salmon for many years with NOAA. His salmon research focused on enhancement technology and broodstock development. He also served on the Pacific Salmon Commission and the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission technical committees and is an avid Chinook salmon sport angler. Bill's presentation is entitled Review of Chinook Salmon Enhancement and Relevant Issues in Southeast Alaska, 1979 to 2012. There you go, Bill. Oh, yeah. There you go.
Thanks, Bob. I've been asked to talk about Chinook enhancement in Southeast and how it might or whether it could be applied to other parts of the state. But first, it's important to ask just why is there a Chinook enhancement program in Southeast? Now, John Burke covered some aspects of that, and I'll quickly go through some other issues related to it. Here is a 132-year history of commercial salmon fisheries in Alaska. You see year-to-year fluctuations with some obvious trend lines. In 73-74, with the White Arrow, statewide salmon harvest was 22 million fish. In Southeast, harvest was 7 to 8 million fish, only 7 to 8 million, 3 years in a row. The alarmed managers, politicians, fishermen, industry, and others began looking for answers. And while they were looking, they saw that there were some hatchery programs elsewhere that seemed to be helping maintain their fisheries, especially in Washington State and in Japan. As they studied the hatcheries elsewhere, they realized that there were a lot of aspects to those that didn't seem to apply for Alaska. So avoiding pitfalls, policies on hatcheries elsewhere led to the current Alaska hatchery program. I'd like to look at some timelines, and John Burke covered this first set of timelines, so we'll not have to go through those again. Note on the bottom, 92, when Fred was merged into Commercial Fish Division, and John's point's well taken, the department, Comfish Division, still has oversight on all aspects of Alaska hatcheries. Some other timelines that are relevant to Chinook include 1960s and 70s, there were depressed coastwide stocks. 76, Congress passed the Magnuson Fisheries Conservation Act, now called Magnuson-Stevens Act. In 77, the 200-mile law was established, EEZ. In 1978, there was a federal fishery management plan for Chinook fisheries in Southeast, and then John mentioned the importance of the U.S.-Canada Salmon Treaty in 1985. Meanwhile, in the early 1990s and beyond, there were 9 Chinook stocks, ESUs, evolutionary significant units, listed under ESA in the Pacific Northwest. Here are the drainage of those 9 ESUs listed under the Endangered Species Act. There are 5 on the Columbia River, 1 in Puget Sound, and 3 in the state of California. So let's look at some of the policies that were established to develop hatcheries throughout Alaska. As John mentioned, primarily designed to favor wild stocks. To mitigate poor fisheries and not enhance wild stocks, hatcheries were sited away from wild stocks. When possible, located on non-anadromous water sources. Most of the hatcheries in Southeast are located at or near tidewater, and no hatcheries were allowed on any major wild stock systems. There were strong genetic and fish health policies, many of which are encoded in state statutes. We developed the concept of conservative fish culture practices, and John mentioned some of those. Careful use of brood stocks from selected areas, limited use of stocks and hatcheries, no mixing of brood stocks, trying to maintain the timing and age group structure of returning adult hatchery fish. And finally, we're charged with trying to develop innovative hatchery technologies. Now, here's just a quick example of some of those innovative fish culture techniques from Southeast. Development of high-density substrate incubators producing large numbers of high-quality fry. Multiple use of net pens in fresh and salt water to have a wide range of fish culture options. The use of hanging lakes for rearing fry at the small stage. And development of floating raceways for effective use in protected estuaries. Now, we haven't talked about this very quickly, but I want to go through one element of basic biology of Chinook salmon. It hasn't been brought out in this discussion so far. There are two basic types of Chinook salmon. Stream type, where the juveniles spend one or more year in freshwater before migrating to sea. They make extensive offshore migrations in the ocean and return to natal rivers in spring or summer. Ocean-type Chinook juveniles migrate to sea during their first year, usually within 3 months after emergence. They make more coastal-oriented migrations and return to natal rivers in fall. Ocean-type Chinook are often referred to as fall Chinook, and stream-type are often called spring Chinook. Most Alaska stocks are stream-type Chinook, although geologically we think many of those stream-type Chinook in certain coastal areas were derived geologically from fall-type parentage. Joe Orsi talked a little bit about this morning. This coastwide view illustrates how migratory patterns affect Chinook issues. Juveniles enter south to north, moving along a narrow band on the Alaska coastal current, shown here in green. After multiple years, unknown numbers, maturing adults rejoin this band along the same area in opposite directions, here shown in red. There are many, many unanswered questions, and we've talked about those in the last 2 days, about when and where stocks go, when the juveniles leave the band and go into the open ocean, or when the adults rejoin the band and go back to their natal areas. Please note that some Chinook from these bands enter and return from the Bering Sea. With Southeast Alaska's location in this grand scheme of things in here, it's not hard to see and not surprising that 75 to 80% of the Chinook caught in Southeast originate from British Columbia, Washington, or Oregon to the south. Now, this pattern was not fully appreciated until more recent years, and I'll tell a quick story that illustrates it. In the 1970s, a study in Kachemak Bay began rearing and releasing Chinook smolts that were tagged with coated wire tags. A few years later, the people involved began looking for tagged adults from this study returning to their Halibut Cove Lagoon area, and it coincided with the development of the late winter, early spring sport fishery in Kachemak Bay at about the same time. In 1980, Joe Wallace from the department began collecting tags from this experiment, this developing sport fishery, expecting to find some of his Halibut Cove cultured fish releases. And here are the results of the first 10 tags that Joe Wallace collected. There are two from Southeast, four from British Columbia, including wildfish, two from Washington, and two from Oregon. This shows the location of principal hatcheries in Southeast, including there are two research hatcheries, one at Auk Creek and one at Little Port Walter. Hatcheries in red incubate and rear Chinook salmon. And John's already talked about the offsite releases of pre-smolts in alternate areas for imprinting. Most hatcheries are located on the islands in Southeast and not the mainland. And you may ask, well, why is this important? Here are the Chinook stocks that have been used in the hatchery program. And recall that we have some pretty conservative fish culture policies involving the careful use of broodstocks. Most of the broodstocks are located on the mainland. King Salmon River is the only extant island stock in Southeast. It's fairly small. Historically, there were other Southeast island stocks, supposedly, that are now extinct. An important feature of these stocks that's been talked about yesterday is spending much of their ocean life in the inside waters, which, of course, provides opportunity for Alaska origin fish fishing opportunities when so many of the other Chinook are caught from outside areas. Phil Richards yesterday explained this quite nicely. But to fully answer some of these questions, we need to look again at the U.S.-Canada. Well, first of all, the three stocks now that are most commonly used in Southeast include the Andrews Creek that John talked about. There's a stock from the Unic River and a stock from the Chickamauga River that are also used in some hatcheries in Southeast. Now, returning to the tree issue, there are many treaty issues with other salmon, but Chinook salmon, they were and are and have been the principal driver of a treaty with Canada. There is an all-gear treaty quota established for Southeast Chinook harvest based on the abundance index of coastwide stocks. The quota allocations among user groups by percentages shown here are developed according to management plans and the Board of Fisheries. And as John mentioned, most Chinook produced from Southeast hatcheries are not counted against this quota, so therein lies the basic reason for Southeast Alaska Chinook enhancement programs, basically to put more Alaska origin fish into regional fisheries, primarily to the trollers. And as John mentioned, troll fishery was hardest hit in reducing catches needed to reach a treaty agreement in 1985, and he talked about the promise of 100,000 additional fish, which we haven't quite been able to reach that yet. So here is a history of Southeast Chinook harvest that reached a peak of 890,000 fish in 1937. At about the same time, another event was happening, and this is the Grand Coulee Dam blocking the whole upper Columbia reach. It went all the way up in a huge area into British Columbia. This was a terrible black mark and a period marking the beginning of many, many other problems with Chinook, especially from the Columbia River. The first Southeast hatchery returns occurred in 1979 and have shown a steady increase until more recent years. This is a period photo of Port Alexander on the lower end of Baranoff Island in the late 1930s, early 40s, right when Grand Coulee was built. And at that time, Port Alexander was known as the troll fishing capital of the whole Pacific coast. They caught a lot of Columbia River origin Chinook. Here are the Southeast Hatchery Chinook smolt releases and adult returns from 1979 to 2012. Both show increasing trends until the last few years. Smolt releases reached a peak in 10.3 million in 2009, and adult harvest peaked in 172,000 in 2004. Peak returns and good marine survivals are indicated in this period, in the late 90s, early 2000s, and it's followed by a downturn, which probably is indicating a broad range of poor, reduced marine survivals. Here are the same four user groups that we saw in that treaty quota issue, showing the yearly fluctuations in the annual harvest in percentages of hatchery Chinook caught in common property fisheries 1993 to 2011. You see fluctuations on an annual basis, but on average, the troll fleet has caught 43% of the harvest of the common property Chinook caught in the fisheries in Southeast. Seine fisheries 19%, gillnet fisheries 17%, and sport fisheries 20%. The trends show recent declines in troll and sport catches, but increase is in the seine and gillnet catches. Now, John talked about the PNP program and how it has the ability through the cost recovery program to harvest a portion of the returning fish to help defray cost. From 1993 to 2011, the common property harvested range from 50 to 80% and average 65% of the hatchery production in Southeast. The cost recovery harvest by the PNP operators range from 20% to 50% and has averaged about 35% during that period. This graphic shows the straying incidental straying of hatchery Chinook into wild systems in southeast Alaska. Because of the treaty focus on enhancement, the protocols required documenting hatchery strays into wild system. So if we look, we see the streams, there's nine streams, wild systems, the years examined, the total number of years involved, the number of carcasses involved. These are Chinook carcasses. Look for missing ad fins so that you can hopefully get a wire tag. Here's the actual number of tags recovered, and then the tags recovered can be expanded based on the tag fraction of the release lots from the hatchery. So, in effect, you see a total number percentage of strays from hatcheries to wilds is a little less than 3/10, but it ranges from about 1/10 to as high in one case over 8% in the Farragut River, which is kind of a unique situation, and we don't fully understand that and why that is so. Here are some marine survivals of age one smolts released in southeast hatcheries from 77 to 2006. Shown again are the hatcheries, the stock, the broods. The numbers range from about 30,000 to over 2 million. Release dates, weights, and the range of survivals measured at the hatcheries from quite low, from 0.1% in one case to as high as 14%. If you average those means up across this, it winds up being about 1.7%, which is roughly what Ed Jones mentioned yesterday, about half of what the wild stocks are surviving. I calculated the survivals for all of the reported southeast Chinook smolts released between 79 and 2006, which was 145 million smolts. And I also calculated and recovered all of the adult returns reported between 75 and 2011, which involved 2.5 million adults. And if you look at those two numbers, 145 million released, that's exactly 1.7%, same value that's shown here. So that's kind of a benchmark for hatchery smolts, I think, in southeast. Here are marine survivals for mid-May yearling releases, Chinook smolts, at the NOAA Fisheries Littleport Walter Station from 76 to 2006. Two different stocks, and there's quite a bit of fluctuation, particularly in the early years here. But there's a long period here of maybe 15 years, 20 years, where survivals range from 1% up to as high as 4%. A couple of cases got a little higher. But in the more recent years again now, here's this sharp downturn in marine survivals. Now, I have to mention that this is selected groups of releases because the research hatchery at Littleport has released literally hundreds and hundreds of research groups of different kinds. These are mid-May releases, yearling smolts, sort of what we call a stock maintenance group to maintain these two stocks. I point out that the last 2 points are actually for the 2007 brood, which only goes through age five fish, and we don't expect many more since those numbers are not going to increase very much. Here are some marine survivals from age zero smolts from southeast from 77 to 2006. Again, the hatcheries, the stocks, the broods, brood years, the numbers are much less. Release dates and weights are smaller. And the range of survivals are much, much lower in this case, there were no returns reported. I'm not sure that's accurate. But overall, the average is about less than 0.5%. Okay, so what's the verdict on the Southeast Chinook Salmon Hatchery Program? We've thrown a lot of stuff here in the last two presentations. So here are four questions, I say key questions, and my short answers to those questions. Number one, do Southeast hatcheries produce more Alaska origin fish for the fisheries? And the answer to that is yes, in part. The photo on the left is a troller, and of course we have it meet the intended purpose of Chinook production to produce the 1,000 fish, 100,000 fish in the trawler's catch that was initially intended. Can Southeast hatcheries be improved? The answer to that is yes, especially with broodstock development and trying to avoid some of those black swans that John talked about. And the photo on the right is showing hatchery broodstock collection with a gillnet in a near-terminal hatchery area. Should Chinook hatcheries and enhancement be expanded in this region, in Southeast? Probably, but with some caution. And then finally, can Chinook hatcheries enhancement tools and policies that I've shown here be effectively used elsewhere in the state? And my answer to that is maybe, with great difficulty, and in most cases, probably unlikely. So next, I would like to give a quick summary of what some of the things that we've covered here, and I hope I'm okay on time. Okay, so we have a rigorous hatchery program. Policies were developed to protect wild stocks. Hatcheries were designed to support depressed fisheries, not to supplement wild stock populations. Chinook hatcheries in Southeast have helped replace treaty-driven harvest reductions, and marine survivals of age one hatchery smolts, while they vary widely, they're going to average somewhere around 1.7%. Southeast hatchery Chinook programs have minimal threats to the wild stocks in the region. In addition, it should be noted the Southeast Chinook hatcheries, and this applies basically to hatcheries anywhere, they can become important research tools, especially in Southeast. They measure contributions to various fisheries. They document life history details by brood and age of maturation, provide accurate marine survival data by brood year. They meet obligations to provide more Alaska origin fish to fishermen in the region, provide detailed ocean distribution and migration patterns, especially when they're collected downstream from release sites. You can release smolts of a constant quality, same size, same time, same nutritional base, that will evaluate, hopefully, marine environmental conditions, become useful indices of ocean conditions or climatic changes. And we heard the first day about full parental genotyping. Hatcheries provide a very effective platform for conducting full parental genotyping research. Thank you for your attention.
Questions, panel? Questions?
Ron Josephson with the Department of Fish and Game. So, Bill, John attributed location as one of the primary reasons that Sarah's programs are Chinook programs are successful. And as it turns out, Little Port is probably, well, from the data that we've seen, it's the most successful location for Chinook salmon releases based on survival rates. You have the highest survival rates of any of the hatchery programs in Southeast. Is that due to location or perhaps stock or good fish cultures, good biologists? Why would you think that is?
Ron, all of those issues that you raised are involved. But location is important. The stocks were important. And I didn't mention, but we have maintained for over 35 years two stocks at the same location, kept them separate, and that's a big job because all of the smolts released from either stock are coated wire tagged, and then the returning adults, when collected, are held until maturity, And at the time of spawning, then the wire tag has to be extracted, and before any gametes are mixed, you're maintaining the integrity of each of those two stocks. But if I had to sum up your question, Ron, I would say it in one word: luck.
Any more questions?